The story this morning is not the version of "This is just to say" that is listed here. It is, in fact, a story from a book called Teaching Tolerance, and it is a story from India called The Prince and the Rhinoceros. Once upon a time in India, a rare rhinoceros was born with skin so beautiful it almost glowed. The rhinoceros was given to a noble prince who was very lonely and whose kingdom was very poor. And the prince was delighted with this unusual gift and laughed joyfully, and so he named this little rhinoceros Great Joy. And Great Joy was the great wealth of his kingdom. The prince treated the rhino with kindness. He fed her rice and fruit and choice tender plants, and he always spoke in a kind and gentle voice. Great Joy grew and was happy. The prince thought that Great Joy was quite beautiful. At sunrise, she would be golden. At sunset, she would be a canvas of pink and red and orange, and later the dark blue of evening. Sometimes after the rain, she would reflect everything around her. She seemed enchanted. "You are so wonderful and special to me," the prince would whisper to her. In time, Great Joy grew to be an enormous rhinoceros, and she was very strong. And one day, she thought about her good life with the prince and what she could do in return for him. She noticed that his kingdom was very poor. And she thought, "Well, I am only a rhino, but I can use my strength and earn some gold for his kingdom." So she suggested to the prince that she compete in a contest of strength against the town's strongest bulls. And one of the rich merchants with fine oxen agreed to a bet. Great Joy would pull 100 loaded wagons, usually towed by his team of oxen. And the bet was 1,000 golden pieces. The prince was delighted because his kingdom had been poor for a long time. The next day, the prince inspected the wagons and harnessed Great Joy to the front, and then he climbed into the driver's seat. And Great Joy waited. Instead of saying what he usually said to his enchanted rhino, the prince, thinking of that gold, waved a whip in the air and shouted, "Pull, pull, move, you worthless rhino!" Great Joy was shocked. The prince had never spoken to her like this. "I am not worthless." She stiffened her huge legs and refused to move an inch. The prince, of course, lost the bet and was humiliated and ran home to his royal bed crying, "I'm ruined." Great Joy was filled with pain and sorrow. She needed to understand what she had done to deserve this. After many days and nights, she went to the prince's palace, which had grown shabby. "Prince, in all our time together, I have never done anything that hurt you, have I? I don't understand what I must have done." "You have done nothing," said the prince. "Well, then why did you say those terrible things to me? Was the thought of gold more than I could offer to you?" The prince hung his head and tears ran down his face. "The gold distracted me and I forgot. I forgot the importance of our friendship. I am ashamed." "Oh, well then, we'll try again," Great Joy said. "Go back to the merchant, double the bet." So the carts were loaded. Great Joy was harnessed to the front. The prince climbed up, and this time he sang out, "All right, you marvelous marvel, you splendid rhino, my Great Joy, all is up to you." And the powerful rhino snorted and pawed the ground and charged forward. Her sides heaved as she pulled until the cart crossed the finish line. The townspeople cheered wildly as they covered her with garlands of flowers and strands of bells. The prince collected his 2,000 pieces of gold and then humbly thanked Great Joy for a job well done. That evening, the prince and the rhino walked along the river in the glow of the sunset. "I didn't mean to say those hurtful things to you," the prince whispered. "Please forgive me." "Oh, I already have," Great Joy said. And that is how they lived forever. A friendship and a great joy. And never again did an unkind word pass between them. This is the beginning of a new day. I can waste it or use it for good. What I do today is important because I am exchanging a day of my life for it. When tomorrow comes, this day will be gone forever, leaving in its place something that I have traded for it. I want it to be a gain, not a loss, a good, not an evil, a success and not a failure, in order that I shall not regret the price I paid for it today. I have another story for you this morning. This one is not a once upon a time. It's a very recent story about two people who learn to forgive, or maybe two people who were struck by forgiveness. This is a story where there might not ever have been forgiveness. This is a story about a woman named Mary and a man named O'Shea. In 1993, when O'Shea was 16, he took the life of Mary's 20-year-old son at a party. The two young men did not know each other. They argued, and there was terrible violence. And let me read you the story collected by the StoryCorps program with National Public Radio. Mary says, "You took my son's life, and I needed to know why. The first time I asked you to meet with me, you said, 'Absolutely not.' So I waited 9 months and asked you again, and you said, 'Yes.' You finally met with me in March of 2005 at Stillwater Prison. And I wanted to know if you were in the same mindset of what I remembered from court when you were 16. But you were not the same 16-year-old boy anymore. You were a man. You had entered my life in one way, and now you were someone else. You came into the meeting room and we shook hands. And I just told you that I didn't know you and you didn't know me. And you didn't know my son and my son didn't know you, but we needed to know each other. And that's mainly what we did for 2 hours. We talked." O'Shea, "I found out that your son's and my life paralleled. We had been through some of the same things and somehow we got crossed. And I took his life without even knowing him. But when I met you, he became human to me. When it was time to go, you broke down and started shedding tears. And then you just started going down. And the initial thing I tried to do was just hold you up in my arms. I was thinking, I can't let her hit the ground. So I just hugged you like I would my own mother. Mary, after you left, I said, 'I just hugged the man who murdered my son.' And that's when I began to feel this movement in my feet. It moved up my legs and it just moved through my whole body. When I felt it leave me, I instantly knew that all of the anger and hatred and animosity that I had in my heart for you for 12 years was over. I had totally forgiven you." O'Shea, "Being incarcerated for so long, you tend to get detached from real love from people. Sometimes I still don't know how to take receiving forgiveness from you. How do you forgive someone who has taken your only child's life? To know that I robbed you of that and you forgave me, I can't put it into words. I served 17 years of my 25-year sentence, and since I got out, I see you almost every day. Although I can never replace what was taken from you, I can never fill that void, I can do the best that I can to be right there for you. I didn't want you to wonder what this guy was doing since he got out of prison. And now you can actually see what I am doing. You live right next door. Mary. It's amazing. We have our conversations on our porch. We share our stories. O'Shea. They go from, hey, I found a job opportunity for you, to, boy, how come you ain't come over here to check on me in a couple of days? You haven't even asked if I need my garbage taken out. I find those things funny, and I appreciate it. I admire you for being brave enough to offer forgiveness and for being brave enough to take that step. It motivates me to be sure I stay on the right path. Mary, I know it is not an easy thing to talk about, us sitting here looking at each other right now. So I admire that you can do this. O'Shea, regardless of how much you see me stumble here, you still believe in me. You still have the confidence that I am going to do the right thing. And you still tell me to keep moving forward, no matter what. Mary, you know I didn't see my son graduate, but you are going to college, and I will be able to see you graduate. I didn't see him get married, but hopefully one day I will be able to experience that with you. Our relationship is beyond belief. O'Shea, I agree. I love you, lady. Mary, I love you too, son. Can you imagine the story? The police coming to her door to tell her that her son has been shot. Can you imagine she attends the trial, she meets this boy and is filled with that physical sense of rage. In another part of an interview, she talks about wanting to hurt this 16-year-old boy. Can you imagine that a decade later she decides she needs to know him? That she goes to the prison to talk to him because she thinks they need to know each other. And then who she meets is not that boy that was in court all those years ago. He is somebody else now. She sits down and talks to him for 2 hours. Can you imagine finding any words in that moment? And then, of course, she collapses in tears, and he catches her, holds her thinking, I can't let her hit the ground. And after being released from prison, he becomes, really, her adopted son. Not officially, but that's what she calls him. How can they have created forgiveness in this unforgivable situation? I think part of it is created by the fact that the person who committed the crime was remorseful, was compassionate in a way that he had not been those years before. There's a picture of the two of them in the book. It's a little tiny black and white photo. He has his arm around her and she's leaned in a bit. She smiles like she is at ease. He does not smile. His face is tender. His eyes look like a man who has been on a long, long journey. Like he has been to hell and back. And I mean that in the universalist sense, that there is no need for a devil or a pit of fire, that there is enough suffering right here in this human earthly existence. To travel to the worst of it and to be able to come back and live next to the woman who is the mother of the man whose life he took. He has had to learn how to let the past be in the past while never forgetting how it affects the present. He lives deeply with the repercussions of what happened. He never has a chance to pretend that it didn't happen. And he has put together a life that demands him to live differently. In their conversation, they acknowledge that she needs to know that he is living differently, just as much as he needs to live differently. In this story, the possibility of her maintaining her forgiveness is knowing that he is a different person now, that he is making different choices every single day. It is more possible to leave the past in the past when we have that confirmation from each other. I also think it's interesting that he couldn't stand to meet with her the first time that she asked to meet with him. That she wanted to know him, but he couldn't do it yet. In this story, the stakes are so high, the emotions are so deep, it's not surprising, but this is true in every situation where people have been wronged and in need of forgiveness. When a person has done something wrong, no matter what scale it's on, the hardest part is facing the person or people who have been hurt. And as you know from your lives, a lot of people just can't do it. They can't stand the pain. And that's why so often people don't admit to having wronged anyone or won't talk about it. They may look like they don't know it's wrong, but I'm pretty sure that most people do. They're just protecting themselves from how much it hurts. They don't actually meet reality. They don't live next door to the reality of what they've done, then they don't have to feel how bad it is. They still carry it with them. It still keeps their lives locked in and small. The story that I share with you this morning is larger and deeper than many of us have to live with. But the process of facing our lives, facing the past, and then living in the present is the same no matter what the situation. It is still difficult to face fully what has happened. Not to minimize it and not to get stuck in it. And you would certainly forgive Mary in this story if she had gotten a little stuck in that story. For Mary and O'Shea, forgiveness is something that happened inside of relationship. Neither of them ever forgets why they know each other. That if the world had gone right, they wouldn't know each other. And Mary talks about her son so freely and openly. He is still there with them in that connection they have made. She hasn't forgotten anything. And she has somehow come to love this man, O'Shea, to live in the present tense with him. So part of how forgiveness happens in this story is just by the fact that O'Shea was willing to meet this woman, Mary, that he was willing to step into that invitation to relationship again, that he could figure out how to stand still and meet her and hear her story, to take in her humanity and the humanity of the person whose life he had ended. To be able to do that, to be able to stand that much pain, a person has to do inner work that is hard to imagine doing. And some of you have done it. The forgiveness that Mary experiences is a physical sensation before it is anything else. It is a sense of something rising up through and then out of her body. And after that physical feeling, she is mentally aware of the release of anger. This is a sort of spiritual, mystical experience that many spiritual leaders have described to us in one way or another. A sensation of things leaving, of being able to sense the change while it is subtle and powerful. This is the kind of sensation that people have when they have wrestled with their own demons. You find stories like hers in the biblical texts. This is the story of people who have looked at their worst and darkest selves, who have actually faced the most difficult parts of who they are, and returned to the world understanding that worst of themselves and also the best. I think we would describe what happened to Mary in this story as a liberal religious miracle. An unexpected transformation into a clearer life. Perhaps an ability to remember that part of ourselves which is always with us and always true. How could anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? I think our Unitarian Universalist claim for the inherent worth and dignity of all people gives us good grounding for learning to forgive, for learning to face these deepest, darkest places that we all carry. Learn to face those so that we can step into the present and forgive and be forgiven. The other principles invite us into this innermost work: justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth. The principles don't, in fact, mention forgiveness directly. But having a spiritual practice, having a place that guides us to that worth, that guides us to that compassion and equity, that leads us to the capacity for forgiveness, both on the active and the receptive sides of it. Spiritual practices are meant to deeply clarify who we are and how we live and get us back to our own essence and most essential choices. I cannot imagine being able to forgive in the way that Mary did in this story. I just can't imagine doing it. And it sounds like she couldn't have imagined it either, that she didn't for at least a decade, and probably not before this terrible experience either. She couldn't conceive of doing it, and then she did. In her case, I think it came because her pain met a deep compassion. If you are lucky, that compassion can come from the person who caused the pain, but most often it doesn't come there. So you have to meet that great compassion somewhere else. You have to look in the world. You have to look in yourself for the compassion that is large enough to hold the pain from the past, that will allow you to step into the present. If you have not forgiven in a moment of revelatory insight in the way that Mary did, don't be discouraged about your life or your story. This might just be an invitation into the rage and sorrow that must come first, that must come to burn away the story and the understandings of the self that are connected to the past. Those must come first so that the compassion can be met. Mary and O'Shea don't say how they got to that moment of conversation. They don't say what it was like to be in that moment when he caught her so that she wouldn't fall to the ground. But it's clear that they both worked hard for that moment of profound humanity. They each had a decade of weeping and raging and self-examination. Forgiveness is not a gentle, soft-spoken thing. It is a tough, hard-won victory that travels with you wherever you go after you learn to live inside its hide. And maybe that hide is named Great Joy.